And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On June 30th, the last edition of Ask Amy, the advice column of Amy Dickinson, will appear in newspapers across the country, ending what has been an eventful and fascinating 21-year run. Last week, I recorded an interview with Amy Dickinson that sadly proved to be technically compromised and corrupted and is not air quality. It breaks my heart because the conversation was actually a wonderful one, if I do say so myself. We covered a lot of interesting area and really probed into what it's been like for Amy to do this advice column over these many years. I'm going to share some thoughts from that conversation after we listen to one of several interviews I've been privileged to record with Amy Dickinson in the past years. Here it is, Amy Dickinson, one of our conversations out of the Morning Show archives. And I am exceptionally delighted to be speaking for the next few minutes with Amy Dickinson. I hope that you recognize that name. She is the relatively new advice columnist for the Chicago Tribune. She's been at it now for over a year. Her column also appears locally in the Racine Journal-Times and in a number of different newspapers. In fact, Amy Dickinson told me as we arranged this interview that our conversation roughly corresponds with the year anniversary of her column becoming syndicated. And Amy Dickinson actually learned recently about a very exciting new outlet for her column. Amy Dickinson, first of all, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. Greg, can I say it?
Yes.
Can I say what I want to say?
Sure.
Hello, Kenosha.
Yeah.
It was like my dream.
How is that?
I just think that Hello, Kenosha is just, it's like my favorite thing to say.
Very good.
I can't explain it.
Well, we'll let you say it as often as you like. Is the exciting news about the newest newspaper to pick up the Amy Dickinson column, is that public knowledge yet?
It hasn't started running, but I guess I can say that, thank goodness, the Washington Post has chosen to pick up the column, and we'll start running it, I think, in mid-October.
Very good. How many newspapers are we talking about now that carry your column?
Funny you should ask. I just learned that I'm now in 88 newspapers, and it's going very, very well, I have to say.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We had the opportunity to speak not long after you began the column, and we got to underscore the fact that you have been, over the years, an occasional commentator on National Public Radio, I think primarily for All Things Considered.
That's right. I'm still at it. I still do those now and then, which is a great outlet for me.
Very good. You told us in the first interview, but let's get kind of a capsule repeat summary of how this exciting opportunity came your way.
Well, I was doing a lot of work for NPR, and I also wrote a column for Time magazine about family life and parenting, and this was Time's effort to kind of do a back-of-the-book, softer stuff. And when Epi Lederer, who wrote the Ann Landers column, died, I had been writing a little bit for the Chicago Tribune and had gotten to know an editor here. And I very jokingly, this was a joke, okay? I emailed him and I said, Now there's a job I could do. He, over the years, had said to me, you know, if you ever want to work for us full-time, you know, just let me know. So I said, there's a job I could do, ha, ha, ha. You know those emails where you just say, ha, 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 ha? Well, he also laughed it off. But about a month later, he came back to me and said, you know, we think we're going to try and replace the Ann Landers column with a new column and would like you to try out. And so I did.
And they wanted you.
And they did.
And the rest has been history. At the time that we did our first interview, you were basically a one-person operation. And if I remember correctly from our most recent chat, you are still pretty much a one-person operation. Is that right?
I am thoroughly a one-person operation. And it's funny because at the outset, I think the Tribune didn't want to commit maybe too much resources to me because we none of us knew how this would go. And I set about, and they gave me a little office, and I set about to try and create a weekly column all my own. And one kind of amazing and great aspect of working so hard solo is that I have created this thing by myself, and it does, I think it has a stronger voice because I don't have anybody else choosing the letters. I open the envelopes, I read the mail, and I think one of the surprises of the column for me is the great importance of choosing the letters. I feel that obviously the letters dictate the column, and I have chosen very interesting. I mean, the letters that come in are so rich and interesting, and they're full of detail. And one of the early decisions I made was to not edit them too much, sometimes for length, but I don't clean them up. I don't change them. I don't alter the grammar. And one aspect of that is that these letters come through. I think there's a richness to the way people present their own problems, and that's coming through in the column.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
And one thing which I have told you before is that I so appreciate the fact that your answers are not, particularly succinct. I mean, it's not the best way to put it, but I appreciate the fact that your answers are as rich and complex as the problems being posed to you, that almost without exception, you do not toss off a quick and glib two-sentence answer to a problem which deserves something more than that.
And, you know, funnily enough, I didn't set out intending to do that, but once I started reading the mail, and again, if I had somebody else going through the mail, I might not have felt this way about it. But once I started reading the mail, I felt that these letters created their own narrative, and I really wanted to kind of honor that by not shortening them too much. One aspect of that is that if you run a letter that's more complex, the answer is also going to be a little more nuanced, and that's what I do. And I worried about that a little bit because it doesn't look like other advice columns because of the length, you know, and visually, it's amazing how often people react to these things very visually. You know, these columns tend to run near the comics, you know, right next to Dilbert and people and the jumble, and people turn to them and they kind of take visual cues from these columns. And one of the things I started hearing early on was, well, this doesn't look like an advice column. And as readers have started to actually read, I have heard from them that they appreciate the nuance and the length. And, you know, and if I write a longer answer, it permits me to tell a joke or refer somebody. I just wrote an answer yesterday where I suggested that somebody go out and rent the movie The Apartment. Hmm. Now, you know, that's a good, I love being able to get that in.
Now, are there people in dark blue suits that would prefer that it be otherwise? Or by and large, are you being allowed to let this column be what it is without too much pressure to conform to the appearance and format of other columns?
You know, it's been my experience that everywhere I've ever worked, there's always somebody in a dark blue suit who would really prefer that everything be otherwise. You know what I'm saying?
It's yes.
Like, fortunately for me, the Tribune just let it go. They let it go. They had such faith in this, which is amazing because I had never written an advice column before. I had not met any of my bosses before I started working here, pretty much. And they showed such faith in me. They just let it go. And it has been, I would say it's been a big success pretty much from the start.
We're speaking with Amy Dickinson, and she's responsible for the Ask Amy column, which appears in the Chicago Tribune and also in the Racine Journal-Times. as well as other papers across the country, 88 of them in all. Amy Dickinson, I wanted to ask you if you would try to take us into the process, inside the process, when you open up that envelope or a letter appears on the screen. By the way, what is the proportion between old-fashioned letters on paper versus letters that come to you via email?
Well, I get between 200 and 300 email a day, and I get about between 25 and 50 U.S. mail letters a day.
Wow.
I'm just going to open a letter right now. What I do is, you know, when I come in, email actually is so easy to scan. You can really very quickly see what a letter is. I try and go through all my email first, and I choose and print out letters that I think are suitable. And I don't always, if anything is urgent, I try to, or seasonal or topical, I try to answer that right away. But some, you know, there's always going to be room in my column for a good letter about adultery or internet porn, or, you know, there are some letters that are just kind of evergreen. So I have a backlog of about 100 letters that I feel like I could run at any time.
As opposed to something that has to do with the start of the school year or something
right,
like that.
Right. And I write the column about 3 weeks in advance because of the way syndication works, and we go through the editing process. So I just finished writing columns through the end of September. So we're that far ahead. So I try to be aware of, because of that timing, I try to be aware of topical seasonal things and run them at appropriate times.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the U.S. mail that comes in, which I have great affection for, you know, there's nothing quite like opening an envelope and reading someone's handwriting.
I could not agree more.
You know, it's really, I'm just opening one. And lots of times it's older people because they may not have access to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And a person will clip a column of mine and enclose it in an envelope along with a letter kind of commenting about it or reacting to it. And I love that. Here's one in pencil. I mean, you know, when was the last time you read a letter written in pencil?
Very good.
Yeah.
Now, when you take in hand a letter, and let's say it's somebody saying, I mean, I'm at my wit's end, my husband is doing such and such, and I'm ready to leave, or I'm ready to go crazy, or one of those where someone is in the midst of something difficult, or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how quickly does the heart of your answer sort of form in your mind? And what do you do with that? I mean, what gets you from that initial reaction, be it what a jerk or what a crybaby or oh, I'm so sorry for you, whatever, to the finished form of what your answer finally is? And does very much happen between those two in terms of maybe a shifting in your answer from what
I do, you know, I have to say this morning, I don't know why I've been having trouble sleeping lately, and I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about a question I wrote the answer to yesterday, and I loved the question. It was from a young woman, 26 years old, who said, basically, what's going on what's going on with this country? I work in an office, I go out to bars with my colleagues, and I get hit on by married men constantly, and I watch my married colleagues cheat on their wives. You know, she said she was disgusted and despairing over this, and I totally understood what she was saying. And it was such a well-done question, and it wasn't like, what should I mean, it was a general question, like, what's going on? And this gave me a chance to say, I actually don't think that life has changed as much as you may think. You know, she said, my parents have been married for 30 years. Like, what happened to the sanctity of marriage? And one of the things I said to her was, when you go to a bar, you get what you get. And one of the things I think you need to do is to stop. I said, stop going into the hen house and looking around and wondering why there are so many chickens there. Like, certain things go on at bars because people are drinking and stupid. So one of the recommendations I made was that she seek to find people who are more like, who share her values. And that she can't know at 26 what I know at 44, which is that you'll be exposed to this sort of behavior that you really don't like. You'll be exposed to it off and on your whole life. And that you need to make actual conscious decisions about how to act, how to live, how to be. And, it was such an opportunity for me to respond to this because I'm speaking as somebody in a, an older generation. I really appreciated her question and her problem. So, yeah, I mean, that answer has taken me a long time to craft it. But the first thing was to choose the letter and, and actually this is the answer where I recommend that she rent the apartment, which is basically all about cheating, and behaving badly. And the main character in the movie is disgusted, his growing disgust at what he sees and his desire to be different. So anyway.
Very often do you find that you read a letter and your immediate impulse is that either the letter writer is pretty much in the wrong or the letter writer is pretty much the victim here. And then as you maybe read the letter a second or a third or a fourth time, you start to see it differently? Or by and large, do you think your initial response to whatever the question posed happens to be is that that's usually pretty much right on the money?
Well, I come to this job as a reader, and one of the things I think that is working well with the column is that I read and interpret the letters very closely. And actually, I got a letter from somebody in my hometown, in fact, who said that this person wrote to me and said he didn't like that I read the letter so closely. And I thought, well, that's interesting, but that's a problem. So I come at this as a reader who I just feel like I do catch a tone. Once in a while, my editor will come back to me and say, I think you're being really hard on this person. Because I get a lot of letters, and in some ways, these are the most fun letters to answer, are the ones from these people who are, like, very, very, very self-deluded and want for me to tell somebody else what to do. This is what I love. It's like, my sister is doing this, that, and the other thing, and I think it's a bad idea, and I want you to tell her blah, blah, blah. And those are great letters because it gives me an opportunity to say, this is so not your business. This is actually not even my business. And it gives me a chance to urge people to kind of attend to their own affairs before they, it's always somebody else. It's always the other guy. And I really love letters where I can say, it's not the other guy. It's you. You're the problem.
Yeah, those are really fun to read, I must say, too. One of the things I wonder is, if you had a person sitting across from you, your sister or a coworker or some other kind of family friend, and you basically wanted to communicate the same thing to them, that, listen, snap out of it, or whatever it might be, you would probably choose your words accordingly for the point of being persuasive. And depending on who it is and the situation, that would have some bearing on how you choose your words. When you write your answers, are you thinking about trying to persuade the letter writer to see this your way?
You know what? It's great that you use that word because that is exactly how I would describe the tone that I take. I have a very, okay, listen to me. And I kind of tone. And I really, when I look at
conversational, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
And when I look at my answers, they're very much my attempt to persuade someone, less than tell them what to do, but more like, hey, listen to this. I've got an idea. Why don't you try this? And one of the things that's helped is that I come at this, you know, as a reporter, and I have been exposed to, you know, I like read the literature. I know basics about very, very basic theories about therapy and techniques, and I'm able to say to somebody, you know, you might be a great candidate for cognitive therapy. That could work for you. Here's how it works, and here's the results that people find. Or I can say to somebody, I get a lot of parenting questions, which I love. And I got one yesterday from somebody who was very upset because his three-year-old, he's a stay-at-home dad, taking his three-year-old off to nursery school, and he was very bummed out to see that another child is in her class, the three-year-old's class, and this child's mother is such a pill. He can't stand her. And what should he do? Should he avoid her? Should he confront her? All this. And I said, you need to act like a three-year-old. Because three-year-olds know that when they're around somebody who throws off bad energy, they find someone else. Three-year-olds are actually really good at avoidance, because they don't know, they lack the language to confront. I said, so, like, pretend you're in nursery school and figure out a way to avoid this person without, you know, it's not up to this guy to tell another mom in his classroom that she needs to be, as he said, less grumpy. Like, that's not his job.
Right.
And one of the things that three-year-olds learn in nursery school is what is their job. And they embrace, you know, they're just at the beginnings of starting to embrace things that are their jobs and things, and they learn which things they aren't supposed to do.
Hmm.
So this was an opportunity for me to say, like, you need to act like a three-year-old now. I love that.
And it's probably not the advice that they're particularly expecting.
No, I don't think so.
We're talking with advice columnist Amy Dickinson about her appears in the Chicago Tribune. I wonder if you would fill us in on maybe one or two of the letters which maybe were most bewildering to you, or the kinds of questions where you feel like the answer is not an easy one to figure out.
Okay, I have to say one of the thorniest things I'm dealing with now is internet porn, frankly. I hear from a lot of people who feel that loved ones are maybe addicted to porn on the internet. And that is a really, really, really tough issue because it's very distressing. It's very time-consuming. A person who has access to the internet is always going to have access to porn. And this is obviously it's a brand new issue, and I don't think that even the big thinkers quite know how to approach it. I mean, it destroys relationships. So that's I would say, just, you know, putting my finger on, that is the biggest pickle for me.
Well, and I certainly remember you time and time again taking up that whole issue of trust when someone seems not to be trustworthy any longer. How do you build that trust again? Is it even
and, you know,
possible?
Sometimes I really feel, and I have been there in my own life, as a middle-aged divorced person, sometimes trust is a choice. And of course, how hard is that? I mean, some of the issues having to do with marriage, I got a letter from a woman who had been betrayed by her husband, and she was at a point where she wanted to forgive him, but she couldn't. And basically, I wrote an answer that was just like, it was like a song. It was just telling her that forgiveness can be a choice. And once you manage to forgive someone, it can take you to a higher place. It's like a spiritual thing. And even if your marriage doesn't survive it, as mine didn't, the ability to forgive someone is so healing. Now, this just came out. You know, this came out of my own experience and my own reading and my own access to people's problems. So, you know, that this is one thing I like. It'd be very easy for me to say, go to a counselor or don't trust that SOB or whatever. He needs to prove this. He needs to jump through flaming hoops. But I think at some point a person does need to make a choice. And forgiveness is sometimes it's the hardest choice to make, but it will take you so far personally. So.
One other quick question, if I may. I was rethinking back to an interview I did a little over a year ago with a woman by the name of Mary Pfeiffer.
Oh, yes.
You know the name?
Reviving a Feeling.
Yes, one of the most renowned therapists in our country. This book we were talking about, actually, more recent, is called Letter to a Young Therapist, in which she talks about her experience of being a therapist and in particular talks about her life experiences, which she feels prepared her to be a therapist. And one of the chief things she points to is being a waitress at a Dunkin' Donuts in San Francisco right off the train during the Vietnam War, and how on an absolutely daily basis, hourly basis, the most fascinating array of people would come in the door. And just in that interaction of waitress to customer, Mary Pfeiffer feels like she learned so much that helped equip her to be such a marvelous therapist and to come to understand the human condition so well. What do you point to in your own life? I mean, you've touched on a couple of things already, that you, for instance, experienced the taste of divorce. You yourself are a mother. But I wonder if there's anything else in your past or where life has taken you that equips you to be this wonderful advice columnist now at this point in your life.
I grew up on a dairy farm in a very scruffy rural area, and our farm failed when I was a teenager, and our belongings were sold at auction, and I saw my family fall apart, and I saw the community do what they could to help. And I think in some ways that those experiences of, you know, genuine hardship and some poverty and some instability really helps me to understand the human condition on a level, you know? I mean, I don't know if you ever, you know, we never recover from our childhoods, and I don't know, I'll certainly never forget that those experiences and really the idea of being surrounded by people who cared, who wanted to help, who wanted to support, who believed in us. So, yeah, I feel that my whole life has led to this. I am not a therapist. I do not have a degree in psychology. I am, like Mary Pfeiffer, a former waitress, a student of the human condition, endlessly fascinated by it.
Amy Dickinson, the advice columnist for the Chicago Tribune and 87 other newspapers, including the Racine Journal-Times and quite recently the Washington Post. Amy Dickinson, keep up the wonderful work, and what a pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. I thank you for your time and for all of your great writing.
Thank you, Greg. And hey, I got your letter.
Very good. The preceding interview with Amy Dickinson was recorded back in 2005. Last week, I recorded a brand new interview with Amy Dickinson, looking back on her 21-year career with the Ask Amy advice column. Sadly, that interview had serious technical difficulties that could not be remedied and rendered it not air quality. I'm very much heartbroken because it was a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed every moment of it. One thing I wanted to mention that we talked about in that conversation was a very interesting distinction between Amy Dickinson's advice column and that of her predecessor at the Chicago Tribune, Ann Landers. Unlike Amy Dickinson, who from time to time has made mention in her column of certain things in her own life, Ann Landers was actually quite private and revealed next to nothing about any aspect of her personal life. That is, until the day that readers opened up the newspaper and read from Ann Landers the announcement that she and her husband were getting a divorce. And Ann Landers famously said, the lady who has all the answers does not have the answer to this one. Amy Dickinson reflected on how a dramatic a breakthrough, in a sense, that was. This was at a time when divorce was still quite a shocking reality to many Americans, something that was perhaps not easy to talk about, looked upon with some shame. And the fact that Ann Landers was willing to be open about this painful reality in her own life really helped to open up lines of communication around this particular topic, much in the same way that there was new openness after Betty Ford revealed to the public some of her own personal struggles with addiction. By contrast, Amy Dickinson over the years has let readers into her own life. And her personal life has changed dramatically over the years. And that has been a part of what has allowed us to get to know Amy Dickinson over these many years. By the way, the voice of Amy Dickinson, of course, is very well known to many public radio listeners for her frequent visits to the public radio program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It was actually at one of those tapings in Chicago that I had my opportunity to finally meet Amy Dickinson face-to-face after having recorded three interviews with her over the telephone. Amy Dickinson is also responsible for several very, very good books, which I would encourage you to seek out. One of them is a wonderful memoir called The Mighty Queens of Freeville, A Story of Surprising Second Chances. She has also written a book called Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things, A Memoir of Love, Loss, and Coming Home. Once again, Amy Dickinson's wonderful advice column, Ask Amy, is coming to a close at the end of this month. Her final column will appear on June 30th. My thanks to Amy Dickinson for being my morning show guest on several occasions. It has always been a great pleasure to speak with her, and I wish her well. Listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out with yet another interview from the Morning Show archives, and a voice very familiar to many public radio listeners. Once again, I have the great pleasure of reconnecting with a fine sports writer with whom I've had the pleasure of speaking on several different occasions, and a name very, very familiar to public radio listeners, John Feinstein. We have spoken about at least two of his previous books, and now talk today about his most recent, which explores a vast universe in the world of sports, professional sports, that many of us know very little about, actually, the world of minor league baseball. The book is called Where Nobody Knows Your Name, Life in the Minor Leagues of Baseball. John Feinstein has followed a number of minor league baseball players through the ups and downs of what is a fascinating facet of the world of baseball. And in many cases, it is a life fraught with frustration and anxiety, and yet at the heart of it is love for the great game of baseball. And in some respects, that love of baseball we experience in its most undiluted form in minor league baseball. This book is published by Doubleday. It's again titled Where Nobody Knows Your Name. John Feinstein, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, it's good to talk to you again. How are you?
Fine. I'm really excited to talk with you. This book is terrific. What a great idea for a book. And at the very back in the acknowledgments, you open up with a really interesting point when you say, the best thing about doing a book on life in AAA baseball is that your job every day is to go to a ballpark. Obviously,
yeah,
there's
more. You can knock that, can you? if you're a baseball fan at any level, and I've been a baseball fan since I was a little kid, and I'm still a long-suffering Mets fan, but played high school baseball and loved to play, and wasn't good enough to go to any higher levels, and so I think I have an appreciation for the guys who make it to AAA, because even though they're not where they want to be, they're not making the big money, they're not playing in Miller Park or any of the major league ballparks you want to name, they're really, really good, and they play the game at a very high level. And more important to me, they all had stories to tell, because more often than not, the best stories are the stories that involve struggle, that involve failure, that involve playing or battling back after injuries or failure. And the hardest part of doing this book, to be honest, Greg, was figuring out what not to write, because there were just so many stories to tell.
You could have written thousands and thousands of pages of very compelling prose. And in your acknowledgments, you go on to say that the second best thing about writing a book about minor league baseball, in a sense, is all about your reception when you walk into that clubhouse or locker room. You are received in a whole different way than if we're talking about the major leagues.
Yeah.
Explain what that difference really is.
Well, major league athletes at any level, whether they're playing in the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA, I don't include hockey in that quite as much, because hockey players tend to be more small town guys who don't seem to be quite as spoiled as athletes in other sports. But for the most part, when you walk into a major league clubhouse, guys take the media for granted. It's like, oh God, there's another reporter. Do I have to do another interview? And there are places in the clubhouse where they can go and hide that are off limits to the media. Minor league clubhouse, first of all, there's no place to hide, because most of the clubhouses are maybe a third the size of a major league clubhouse. But second of all, they look up and they see a guy walking in, and they're like, oh, there's a reporter here. That's different, because there really aren't that many guys who cover minor league baseball on a day-to-day basis. There might be a couple of local guys, but not that many. So when I went into the various clubhouses in the International League and started introducing myself and explaining to players and coaches and managers and broadcasters and umpires what it was I was doing, they were all like, oh, that's a cool idea. Sure, I'd love to talk to you. And as I said, they were all willing to give me a lot of their time, were very patient with me, didn't mind when I went back for second or third interviews. And so it was a wholly pleasant experience, which, as you know, reporting is not always that way.
Hmm. This book ends up being a book that, while it takes in a sense, the whole world of minor league baseball, or at least one level of the world of minor league baseball, it focuses very specifically on a handful of players that, in your words, run the gamut of life in AAA. First of all, explain what you were anxious to do in selecting a few players and how you went about ultimately choosing these particular players as the focus of your book.
Well, the selection of the players was almost at random, in the sense that I didn't go in with any preconceived ideas.
Please stand by. explain what you were anxious to do in selecting a few players and how you went about ultimately choosing these particular players as the focus of your book.
Well, the selection of the players was almost at random, in the sense that I didn't go in with any preconceived ideas that this guy or that guy was going to be a major part of the book, or that I was going to have two pitchers and two infielders and two outfielders. I just sort of let the stories carry me in that direction. And as I went along, I found a guy like Scott Ellerton, who was literally retired from the game and went to took his son to a game in Denver to see a couple of old friends. He'd pitched in the major leagues for 8 years and was standing behind the barrier where they put fans who are allowed on the field before a game, and said, "What am I doing here? I'm a ball player." And literally called out to Ruben Amaro, who's the general manager of the Phillies, and said, who didn't recognize him, by the way, initially, introduced himself or reintroduced himself and said, "Do you think there's any chance I could play baseball again?" He'd been out of the game completely for 3 years. And Ruben Amaro said, "Well, if you want me to watch you throw, I'll take a look." And came out, watched him throw, and signed him to a AAA contract. So I thought that was a compelling story. So Scott became part of, you know, one of my major characters. And as I went along, I had found a couple of managers who'd been through some personal traumas, who had a different perspective on the game, even though they still love it, than many other people do. I found an umpire who was right there on the cusp. People forget that umpires want to get to the big leagues too, just like players. The difference being, if you don't make it to the majors, they just fire you. It's not like you don't have the option to go back to AAA. They just say, "We feel you've reached your potential. You're not going to be a major league umpire, so you're fired, and you have to go find another job. You don't have the option to go back and play an umpire in the minor leagues. It's gone." So I wanted to have a real cross-section of stories, guys who'd had success, guys who'd never had success in the sense of being in the major leagues, and guys who had done both, had succeeded and failed. And these guys all had those stories to tell, and just as importantly, were willing and able to tell the stories quite well, I think.
Right. I guess that's where you maybe struck gold, beyond just the fact that they had compelling stories, but that they are also, these are guys who, in a sense, know how to tell their own stories, mm-hmm. or know how to express themselves, or didn't seem particularly reluctant to let you in on their own joys and their own sorrows and frustrations. I mean, without that level of openness, this wouldn't have been the same book.
Absolutely right. And again, I'm always grateful to my sources for the time they give me, for the, as you say, the openness they display. One of the great advantages of doing a book, Greg, is you do have time to develop trust. It's not as if you just come barging into the locker room or the clubhouse after a game saying, you know, "What pitch did you throw? What pitch did you hit?" Whatever it might be. You can sort of sit down, get to know them. Tell me your life story. How did you get started in baseball? You can go through all that and for hours and not get to the point where they're playing professionally yet, and they're still telling you the story. And when you go back the second or the third time, I think they almost view you as friends returning to sit there and listen to them talk. And I think in many ways, many guys at least enjoy it. And I guess Chris Schwinden, who is one of these players you described as being a main focus of the book, summed the book up best for me one day. We were sitting in a dugout in Buffalo, of all places, and he said, "You know, there's never been a baseball player alive who grew up dreaming of playing in AAA. But this is where I am right now, and I've got to do my best to get out of here." And I think that, more than anything, sums up the life of a AAA baseball player.
Right. I have to insert something here that has absolutely nothing to do with baseball, but a little bit to do with your book. My other real life is as a voice teacher at the collegiate level. And so, you know, I have young men I teach who dream of being opera singers someday. Mm-hmm. Their dreams are, I mean, when they think about what that life is, they picture the Metropolitan Opera. They don't picture the Tulsa Opera or the Palm Beach Opera. And that, in a sense, is roughly akin to what we're talking about. And everybody, when they wish upon a star, has dreams that are of the top echelon of whatever it is they're doing, when in fact the real life that is lived by most baseball players, by most professional opera singers, has nothing to do with those famous stages, but other stages in other places.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and I can relate to what you're talking about because my dad was the director of the Washington Opera for many years and would talk about when he would have tryouts for parts, usually not the starring roles, because the starring roles, you know, you go out and you say, I want you and I'll pay you this much to come and sing the role of Pagliacci or whatever it might be, depending on the opera. But for the backup roles, he would, you know, bring in 20 people and have them sing from the role. And 19 of them didn't get the job. And he had to tell those 19 people, thank you very much for coming in, but we're going to go with John. And that it's true, in as you say, in any walk of life. And these guys in AAA baseball are the ones who are right there. And in some cases, they have been to the Metropolitan Opera. They have been to the Washington Opera. They have been to La Scala. Miguel Tejada, who was in AAA when I was researching this book, was an MVP with the Oakland Athletics. Jamie Moyer won 270 games in the major leagues. Dontrell Willis was a Rookie of the Year. So you have guys who have been there and have now slid back to Tulsa, for lack of a better example, and are trying to get back to the very top. And they're willing to do it because, A, they believe they can get there, and, B, they're like me. They still love coming to the ballpark, even if they're not getting paid the big money and they're not singing it on the stage at the Metropolitan Opera.
Right. They end up realizing that what they love is baseball or singing,
right,
and it's not that they love stardom. I mean, not that stardom maybe isn't nice in many respects, but they perhaps learned that their true love, their one true love, is the thing itself. Scotty Larton says something interesting towards that effect. You quote him at one point as saying, as he looked around, he had been in the major leagues and is looking around in the minor league and saying, wait, I don't belong here, I'm a big leaguer. But the game usually gives you what you deserve,
right,
good or bad. I'm sure many players who find themselves in minor league baseball can't bring themselves to say that or don't, in fact, believe it. But do most of them see it that way?
I think it evolves. I think it's like with anything, when life doesn't go the way you want, there are all the stages of dealing with tragedy. And obviously getting sent down to the minor leagues isn't a tragedy, but it's certainly a setback. And you go through the various stages, and you I think as you get older, Ellerton was 36 years old when I was researching the book, you come to realize it's not because a manager was out to get you, it's not because somebody else was a favorite of the general manager, it's not because you had this injury that just kept you from pitching quite as well or hitting the ball quite as well as you once did. It's because at that moment in time, you're not good enough.
Hmm.
And you have to figure out how to be good enough again. And the sooner you realize that, Charlie Montoyo, the manager in Durham, who was one of the managers who became one of my focus guys, like always when a guy came back from the major leagues, the first thing he would do is he would take him in his office and he would say, okay, tell me what you think you need to work on to get back to the major leagues. And he said most of the time the player knew what it was. He understood, and he'd say, okay, let's go work on that. Now, if he didn't, then he knew he had a harder job to do if the player was still in denial about what had happened to him.
Mm, it felt like they'd been treated unjustly.
Right. Why am I here? I mean, and they all look around and say, why am I here? Buck Showalter managed in AAA for 4 years, and when I was starting research on the book, he said, you know, managing AAA is the worst job in baseball. I said, why? He said, because nobody wants to be there.
Mm.
That includes umpires, broadcasters, anybody else, you know, players, coaches, managers. And they're all struggling to get to, because they're so close. It's not like it's way off in the distance. It's right there. They can reach out and touch it. They have touched it in many cases. And that's why it can be difficult to be a AAA manager, because you're dealing with all these fragile egos.
It's a fascinating story, I mean, on so many levels, and so is your book, again titled Where Nobody Knows Your Name, Life in the Minor Leagues of Baseball, published by Doubleday. John Feinstein, you've done it again. Thank you for writing a really interesting book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Greg, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
It's 8:59. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Larry Tye and his wonderful book about Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington called The Jazz Men. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois, partly sunny skies today and once again hot. Today's high 90 degrees. Overnight low tonight under clear skies of 74 degrees. Not quite so hot tomorrow. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. The time is